from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. The Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray is having a moment. The groundbreaking lawyer, Episcopal priest, and poet has long been revered in Durham, North Carolina. There are murals dedicated to her. Here at WUNC, we released Pauli, a three-episode podcast about her life in 2021.
In each case, I personally failed, but I have lived to see the thesis upon which I was operating vindicated. And what I say very often is that I've lived to see my lost causes found.
Also in 2021, the acclaimed documentary, My Name is Pauli Murray, debuted.
Pauli was the writer, the lawyer, the priest, the poet.
Pauli Murray was not just an amazing lawyer or a badass feminist, but also a queer non-binary person.
Later in the hour, we'll hear more about how the U.S. Mint has decided to honor Murray with a quarter bearing her image. Well, I'm here in the studio with someone who knows more about Pauli than most. Rosita Stevens Holsey is the niece of the civil rights icon and co-author of the new book, Pauli Murray, The Life of a Pioneering Feminist and Civil Rights Activist. Rosita, welcome to Due South.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, I have to ask you this, and you probably have been asked this a million times, but just what's your earliest memory of your aunt?
I would say when I was probably 5 or 6, in Baltimore with the family. My mother and a sister, Mildred, both lived in Washington for years after they finished school. And we had some relatives that were still in Baltimore. So we used that as for Thanksgiving and holidays and big family reunions. But Washington was considered Aunt Pauli's Washington, D.C. headquarters, and she never had to stay in a hotel. She could stay with either my family or Aunt Mildred's family.
And you live in Washington, D.C. now. Have you always been there?
No, I haven't. I was born in Massachusetts. Then I lived in Topeka, Kansas, and then Cheyenne, Wyoming. And then we moved to Washington.
So, you know, we know Pauli Murray as this titan, you know, of civil rights legislation and women's rights, but I guess you knew her as family. You know, what was she like?
A very distinctive person. I mean, if you met her, even if you were only in her presence, I think 5 or 10 minutes, I don't think you would ever forget her. There was just something about her, some aura that surrounded her, the way in which she spoke, the things that she talked about, the various subject matter that she could talk about. And I always felt her mind was always racing. I'm sure there were plenty of times when she sat and she thought, but to me, she just seemed like somebody who was on the move. There were things that needed to be done. She needed to take care of them, or she needed to help. And so she seemed very different from her brothers and sisters, even though all of them were college educated and, you know, gainfully employed and had wonderful jobs. But she was just different. When I began to research her, I found out that her mother had always thought that she was different. And she had asked Aunt Pauline, the namesake aunt, to take care of her if anything ever happened in which they would need to divide the family.
That was her godmother who lived in
yes,
Durham.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, when I would speak to other family members over these past years, several years, one thing they would always say is that, oh, you know, that their aunt, she was just a very serious woman. And so she didn't waste every time, every moment you were with her was a teachable moment. Let's put it that way. Like, she didn't waste time like, oh, look at the pretty things around here. Look at the flowers. No, it was serious because she felt we were in serious times during her lifetime. You know, absolutely. So much changed for women and for Black people in America.
And it was just amazing how, as a very young child, because she was here 9 months when my grandmother was carrying my mother. But and she remembered being here, and of course she had a bond that had formed with Aunt Pauline. But even to come here as a very young child, she noticed the differences. She noticed that people were treated differently, that especially with reference to your skin color. So she didn't use the words or necessarily know the word of segregation or anything like that, but she said, it's unfair here. We're not treated fairly. And she began to form opinions about things. And as a very young child, she didn't balk at being here. She loved her family here. But her goal was always, as soon as I finish high school, I need to leave the South and find something better and find a place where she could feel like an equal or a regular human being. So she was very perceptive.
Yes, she was. And she did leave right after high school. Mm-hmm. But she, we know so much about her life now that she had some very hard times when she did go to New York and she did go to other places, not just in this country, but around the world. So yeah, I know you've devoted a great deal of your time to raising Pauli Murray's public profile.
Yes, I can just say briefly that I came to Durham because I kept hearing that something was going on there and it was connected somehow to Duke. But I had never read anything or received a letter or been called about it. And so my niece Rhea brought me as a birthday gift. And the day that we arrived, the hotel clerk heard me talking to Rhea about Aunt Pauli and asked, were we talking about Pauli Murray? We said, yes. She said, did you come to go to feast day? And no. And are you going to St. Titus? No. And so the clerk told us, this evening there's a special program in honor of her for feast day at St. Titus. I think you ought to go. And so we did. And that really started me on a different journey. I was just overwhelmed by the people who were there. Everyone in the church had come to honor her, to hear about her, to say something about her, or just to be a part of this annual celebration. The bishop was there and a lot of high-ranking people from the church. And by the time all of the ceremonial things were over, they invited everyone in the church to an ice cream social. And that is when I really saw how Aunt Pauli had touched people's lives.
Oh, Durham adopted her. we feel she's ours. We know she wasn't born here, but we know she was raised here. And even though she left, now you can see a little bit of Pauli Murray, I think, all around town.
And I haven't, but I did do that weekend. And so just to say it quickly, I was just so touched by people. A few people had met her. There were people who had read things she had written, people who had read other books about her. But obviously, she meant a great deal to different people. And by the end of the ice cream social, someone came up to me and said, can I hold your hand? And so I gave them my hand, and they said, you have the same blood that she had. I just want to touch you. And by the time it was time to leave, I was on cloud nine. I was having an out-of-body experience. I didn't know what to really make of it. And they needed to clear the church. We'd already kept them an extra hour because everybody wanted to say something to me or my niece. And so we were waiting for an Uber. And my niece looked at me and said, what do you think? And I said, this is unbelievable. what are we going to do? And she said, well, what do you mean, what are we going to do? I said, well, look what everybody else is doing. Look what people in Durham are doing. And they've never even met her. I said, we're her blood. We're her family. It's our responsibility to get involved. And I think it would be an honor to do so. And sitting right out front waiting for the Uber, I said to her, well, you know, I've been teaching and children need to know about her. Young people need to know about her. Perhaps I could write a book. And that really started me on a journey. And then the next day we went to the Pauli Murray Center, which wasn't open, but Barbara Lau took us through and shared information. And so we got to see what their theme was and what they were trying to build. And then we did the murals. So when I left here, I was just fired up and ready to go. And I made up my mind at that point that I should retire and write a book and see how I could promote the legacy of my aunt. And the more I learned, of course, there were a lot of things I didn't know that she had accomplished.
I know we keep learning about Pauli Murray. We need to take a quick break right now, but we'll be right back. I'm here with Rosita Stevens-Holsey. She's the niece of the Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray and president of Preserving Pauli Murray, LLC. And after the break, we'll have definitely more with Rosita, and we'll also bring in Angela Mason. She is executive director of the Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice. You're listening to Due South. You're listening to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. I'm here with Rosita Stevens-Holsey, niece of the Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray and the co-author of Pauli Murray, The Life of a Pioneering Feminist and Civil Rights Activist. You know, we're here to discuss really ongoing efforts to preserve Pauli Murray's legacy, both locally and nationally. But first, I have to hear you read, Rosita. I want you to read from this book. And it's one of my favorite part of the book, The Bottoms, The Influence of Place.
The Bottoms, The Influence of Place. The activist was born, but also formed. In the little house in the Bottoms, her concept of family and her concept of self were totally different from the other five Murray children. They were brought up in Baltimore, Maryland, a city in the north, not quite as free as the state of New York, one would say, but still not North Carolina. At first, the little house was a source of pride, pride of ownership for Cornelia and Robert, different from most Black families. But in time, it became isolating. Maplewood Cemetery was built behind the house in the Bottoms, with fields separating the house from the final resting place of the whites of Durham, North Carolina. But as the cemetery grew, the graves marched down the hill until they were so near, marble angels and headstones became the closest neighbors of the little white house. Walking through the cemetery was forbidden for people of dark skin. But Pauli decided at an early age that was a rule, not a law, that some white person made could be broken. Maplewood Cemetery was a shortcut to everywhere, and she used it, but only during the day. Ghosts, Pauli thought, were sure to come out at night. Pauli talked to the newly dead, welcomed them to their final home. I knew more about the dead white people than the living ones, she said. But it wasn't by choice. It wasn't only the cemetery that isolated young Pauli. In the little house in the Bottoms, water flowing downhill from the cemetery poured freely into the Fitzgerald property. Robert Fitzgerald dug a 4-foot ditch to tame the flow, but the city of Durham covered it. regardless of how much the Fitzgeralds asked and pled with those in authority to have the city uncover the ditch. It never happened. To the whites who made the decision in Durham, North Carolina, water flooding the house of a black family was of no concern. Friends were hard to come by when your house swam with water when it rained. Friends were hard to come by when Pauline Dame and Sally Fitzgerald, your mother and your aunt, taught at your school. Friends were hard to come by for a girl who liked to wear boys' clothes instead of girls. Friends were hard to come by for a girl whose grandmother ranted at those who neared the little house in the bottoms, coloring Pauli Murray's life with loneliness.
That's quite compelling. And if you didn't know who Pauli Murray was or is, you know now, don't you? Because that tells us a great history of how she grew up and where, in a way, she got her fight from. I mean, she wasn't going to be always questioned and always told no, I gather, right, Rosita?
Absolutely.
You know, about that house, that's why I'm very glad to have Angela Mason here today.
Hi.
Hi there. The executive director of the Pauli Murray Center for, I want to call it so many names. It's like her, the home where she grew up, but it's also very special because it's becoming just a place where those who, would like to study Pauli Murray, it's a center for history and social justice. And actually, a lot of folks just find it peaceful just sitting on the lawn, mm-hmm. don't they?
Absolutely.
Tell us about that house and what it's becoming every day.
So this is the home where Pauli Murray was raised, a home that was built by their grandfather in 1898, a home where their mother and aunts were raised, a home where Pauli Murray developed their earliest concepts of democracy, citizenship, identity. I consider the Pauli Murray Center and really that home at 906 Carroll Street sacred space because that is absolutely what it is. It is a home that's a touchstone to a remarkable human being in Pauli Murray. It's a home that is a remarkable touchstone to liberation of a Black American family. It is a home that can tell a story to help us understand that all people belong, right? This is a home that is in a historically Black working class neighborhood in Durham called the West End. This is a home that helped to shape a life of a queer person, a Black person who stood against social injustice for a lifetime. And so again, this is why I called this space a sacred space. And we're so fortunate that it still stands before us today, so many generations later.
I know. I've been there several times through really this transformation. Mm-hmm. I think I tried to be around when your center, was able to purchase the property, with a lot of help of people in the community. And then I was there when the lawn was cleared and you couldn't really go inside, yeah. not yet. But, even when is the U.S. Forestry Service stepped in?
National Park Service.
The National Park yes. Service, because this place wasn't just a place that, we love it in Durham, but no, it needed to be on a national registry mm-hmm. of some sort. And it is today.
It is. And the Pauli Murray Center, again, that house on Carroll Street has been through years of transition. As you named, in the early 2010s, advocates, activists, and stakeholders banded together to ensure that that home would be saved because it was slated for demolition. And without the activism of that group, that home likely would not be standing today. In 2015 or 2016, the home was named a National Historic Landmark by the National Park Service, which is the highest designation a historic space can receive in this nation. And we're grateful that we've continued to see transition. We've spent the last, frankly, decade renovating and restoring that home, and we are wrapping that work up. We're really grateful. And so sneak preview for this audience.
Yes, please tell us, when will it be open?
Yes, so the Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice will be open to the public this fall. So after many, many years, we look forward to welcoming people home and welcoming ancestor Pauli back home to that space.
You know, a big step towards, you know, ongoing efforts to remember Pauli Murray. You know, she was an Episcopal priest, you know, the first Black woman to even have that designation to be ordained an Episcopal priest. And we know about what she did for civil rights, you know, even her words and her thoughts helping to shape Brown versus the Board of Education. I mean, I can go on and on. But I don't think, out of all the ways to remember and honor Pauli Murray, I ever thought a coin. I ever thought that her face would be on a coin that's in my pocket. It's the 11th edition to the Mint's American Woman Quarter Series. So I would like both of you, Rosita and Angela, to talk about that, because you've been, I think, going to a few parties in Washington, D.C. to celebrate this this great point in the history of Pauli Murray.
Yes, we have been celebrating for many, many months. So the Pauli Murray U.S. Quarter was released in January. That's when it started going into circulation. And it is quite remarkable to see the image of Pauli Murray on a piece of currency. There's absolutely nothing like it. And it is really moving and very powerful to hold that piece of metal in your hand with Pauli Murray, who represents who and what the spirit of this nation could be, again, on that piece of currency. And we've had the opportunity to celebrate with the organization that Pauli Murray co-founded, the National Organization for Women. We've had the opportunity to celebrate with the Howard University School of Law in Washington, D.C. We recently had the opportunity to celebrate with the governor of North Carolina during his annual Women's History Month celebration. And in a few weeks, we will be celebrating in Pauli's home place in Durham. And so, again, it's just so remarkable that people are excited to see this incredible Black person on a piece of U.S. currency. I'll also offer that Pauli is at least the second person with North Carolina ties to be featured on a U.S. quarter. And as far as we know, one of the only members of the LGBTQIA+ community. And so when we say this is really remarkable for many communities, we absolutely mean it. And Aunt Rosita was there, I would argue, when the quarter was being conceived. So she can tell you a bit more about that.
Oh, definitely. Because for our audience, you know, we're on radio. You know, but how would you describe this quarter, Rosita? What does it look like?
It shows her looking through the word hope. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so poignant because through all the trials and tribulations that she went through from childhood till death, being a female in a man's world, being Black when that was not only not important, but was definitely a problem. And she just never gave up hope. Everything that she did seemed to be forward moving. I don't know if I could have gone through the life she did and not felt some kind of rage or anger over what I was experiencing, But she always seemed to get around it or go through it or just continue on with hope that she had. It was so much a part of her being. I had the pleasure of working with the U.S. Mint during the first couple of months when they are determining the process. So there are actually two or three organizations that submit names of people they think should be on the quarter. Then there was a public opportunity for people to submit individuals. And after getting several hundred names, I think they whittled that down to about 50 and then did a deeper dive into their background as to what they could present, why this person could be considered deserving of that. And eventually it went down to about 10. So when I was working with the people at the U.S. Mint, we were asked many questions. We were asked what we thought should be honored about the person. We were told that there would be one artist that worked on the design of the coin and then the person who actually did the metal work. I was thrilled that it turned out that a woman actually designed the coin using various aspects of her life. And also that a woman had designed the reverse side, which was of George Washington, that was about 70 years before to have been used on a coin, and a male Secretary of Treasury vetoed it. And so it had just been sitting around, not used. And so Director Gibson, the black female head of the U.S. Mint, decided to bring it out and to use it for the American Women's Quarter Program. So that was very exciting. And we were told we weren't to talk about it. We needed to wait until Secretary Yellen made her decision and approved the last group, and that there would be five. Another thing that excited me, especially as an educator,
what a secret to have to hold,
right?
was that they found people from all walks of life and all cultures. So it's just amazing to see Native Americans honored, Hispanic Americans honored, Asian American honored, and recognizing not only people who maybe invent things or are doctors, but people who have contributed to the arts or contributed to writing and all. So I found that quite exciting, and I was thrilled to know that Congresswoman Barbara Lee wrote the legislation along with Gonzalez, and that they actually got it through Congress. That was amazing. My only disappointment is that they're going to stop at 20. I just wish that they would carry this through for the next, for eternity, finding five women
they're going to stop 20 at 20 women,
a year, and you know, sharing it with the entire country and giving all of us the opportunity to suggest people and, you know, vote on people.
Well, one special gift for me, my younger sister, Cassandra Inge Burks, we were actually traveling home for a family funeral. And when we were getting dressed for the funeral, she says, "I have something for you." She gave me a Polly
Ring. Oh,
wow. That was so special. And I think my favorite part of this coin is that it actually, you know, has a line from her poem, Dark Testament, on the A Song in a Weary Throat. And you know.
And her autobiography.
Yes.
So and, it hits two ways.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap up this time, you know, Angela, I have to at least ask you, you know, what sort of impact do you hope even Polly's American, you know, Women Quarter series, you know, will have in educating just the public about her life and work?
I am hopeful that there will be more people who seek to be in relationship with Polly on one hand. On another hand, I'm hopeful that this quarter reconnects people to the work of Reverend Dr. Murray, but also the really important strategy that Reverend Dr. Murray employed to do their work. This is a really critical moment, I think, to have a touchstone like a Polly Murray quarter. And ultimately, I like to say that Polly was an Afrofuturist. Their work was to build worlds for women, Black people, and queer people that ultimately they would never see. And I think that's a really wonderful reminder as we are doing world building and movement building work today.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for being here.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
Rosita Stevens-Holsey is the niece of the Reverend Dr. Polly Murray and president of Preserving Polly Murray, LLC, and the co-author of Polly Murray, The Life of a Pioneering Feminist and Civil Rights Activist. And Angela Mason is the executive director of the Polly Murray Center for History and Social Justice in Durham. Up next, we'll hear more about the life and legacy of Polly Murray. This is Due South. Welcome back to Due South. I'm Leonida Inge. Today, we're reintroducing Polly Murray. Those of us who live in Durham, North Carolina, claim Polly as our own. She was raised in the West End, a top graduate of Hillside High School, and in the late 1930s, Polly vigorously fought, unsuccessfully, to integrate the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We like to say she learned to fight in Durham and used those skills to fight for civil rights and gender rights in this country and abroad. It's no surprise she's been honored with her image on a quarter by the U.S. Mint. One of Polly's last major fights was to become an Episcopal priest. In the WUNC podcast, Polly, I spoke with two women who credit Polly with opening the doors to the church and to their careers. These interviews were recorded in 2021, the year the podcast was released.
Polly Murray was a bad, a bad Black woman.
You're so polite, because when my mic was off, I was saying, she's a badass, right?
Well,
I wasn't.
See,
I was like, you're not going to say that, but I guess I can say
that. Listen, I'm not going to lie. That was in my mind, but I had to, you know.
Kelly Brown Douglas is dean of the Episcopal Divinity School at Union Theological Seminary in New York City.
I also serve as canon theologian at the Washington National Cathedral.
Dean Douglas has been a part of the Episcopal Church for a while now. She was ordained in the early 1980s, and throughout her journey in the clergy, Polly Murray has been with Dean Douglas along the way.
What I knew of Polly Murray as a young priest or aspirant for the priesthood was that, wow, you know, this Black woman took on the Episcopal Church in the sense that she was, wow, first Black woman to be ordained a priest, and that could not have been easy. And so I always had this deep sense that Polly Murray really paved the way.
But like in every other chapter of Polly's life, there were some hurdles in the road. When she entered seminary in 1973, the Episcopal Church was not ordaining women. But Polly still went, without a guarantee she would ever become a priest.
What's interesting to me is that she went to seminary knowing that she may not be ordained because they were not, the Episcopal Church wasn't ordaining women, though she had fought for the ordination of women prior to that. So she went to seminary to live into, to understand more her own faith journey and what that required of her.
My strong conviction that basically all of these problems of human rights in which I had been involved for most of my adult life, sex, race, all of the problems of human rights, that basically these were moral and spiritual problems.
She moves toward accepting a call into the priesthood and going into seminary. But I think it's much more than that. In those times, you find yourself really asking these other sort of questions about who you are. You know, I always say I'm a theologian. People don't do theology because there's nothing better to do. Theology emerges out of these contradictions or crises in life when we are forced to ask, who is God and who are we in relationship to God, etc. Who has God called us to be? That's what happened for her.
I begin to realize that universally, all of mankind is constantly falling down from these high ideals which we have set. That racism and sexism are actually sins, the sickness of sin. That human beings are not really in harmony in relationship to their Creator.
The Episcopal Church wasn't anything new for Pauli Murray when she entered seminary. She grew up going to St. Titus Episcopal in Durham with the grandparents and aunts who raised her.
From earliest childhood, I have always been a part of the church. There have been times when I have left it, but I have always more or less been in some way involved with the church.
Pauli preserved this connection between faith and family throughout her spiritual journey. Shortly after she was ordained, Reverend Pauli Murray offered her first Eucharist at the Chapel of the Cross in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Choosing that church was intentional. It's the same one where Pauli's grandmother, Cornelia, was baptized more than a century earlier while still enslaved. Through this tribute to her family lineage, to her roots, Pauli was tapping into a calling Dean Douglas says had been there since the beginning of her life.
You know, I like to say, if you're a priest, you're called from the womb. Pauli Murray was called from the womb. You may or may not recognize it, but she did. And if you sort of look at her life's journey, Pauli Murray was being a priest throughout her life's journey in so many ways. And so to read back in, you can see, yep. This was the inevitable sort of last, if you will, part of this journey.
How does Pauli's priesthood mirror the social justice work that she did for decades? You know, in a way, she continued that work even going into the priesthood. Maybe she almost saw it as parallel work. And I don't know, the priesthood may have been the cherry on the top.
Yeah. First of all, you know, this allows us to know that it's one thing to be a religious institution and another thing to be church. And so she found herself, even obviously prior to going to seminary, trying to push the institution that was the Episcopal Church toward being more inclusive. So pushing it to ordain women, pushing it to ordain LGBTQ persons, etc. Pushing it, I like to say, to be church.
The church which one would expect to be on the side, A, of the oppressed, on the side of human dignity, on the side of human equality. Sexism calls in God as its authority. And incidentally, this is the whole thing that is, this is the basic theological argument in barring women from the priesthood. that the male, that God represents the male principle, that Jesus Christ himself was a male and that he selected male apostles. And therefore that it is impossible for a woman to represent Christ.
I also like to think that as she moved toward seminary and the priesthood, that there was no separation between sort of the secular and the sacred side of her. This was about one piece. And it so reflects in so many ways the Black faith tradition, that in the Black faith tradition, the church is indeed, as W.E.B. Du Bois once said, the religious center and the social center. These two things go together. And so they came together in Pauli Murray. So that wasn't sort of this divide for her. And the cherry on top is, you would say, was that she would get to be ordained, but that was no different than the way in which she fought for inclusivity in this daggone country.
Pauli retired from the priesthood in the early 1980s. She passed away just a few years later in 1985 from pancreatic cancer. But her spirit in the Episcopal Church continues to shape it as more and more clergy follow in her footsteps.
You know, I think in a real visible sense that her legacy is the fact that we now have 6 Black female diocesan bishops. That wouldn't have happened without a Pauli Murray. It just wouldn't have. And each of those women recognize the significance of Pauli Murray.
We've talked a lot on this podcast about deserved recognition for Pauli Murray and what kind of tributes to her legacy are appropriate. If you haven't heard our earlier episodes, check those out right after you finish listening to this one. In 2012, Pauli was finally honored in a manner no one could argue befit her greatness. The Episcopal Church elevated her to sainthood. Saint Pauli. Now that has a nice sound to it.
Pauli Murray was what we would call a progressive Christian before we even knew what progressive Christians were. And some of that, I'm sure, came from her clear awareness about kind of who she was and her own value. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't be here without her. And if she hadn't brought that theological lens to the church and really, really advocated for it. My name is Kim Jackson. I am an Episcopal priest, so I guess technically I'm the Reverend Kim Jackson, and I'm also the senator-elect for Georgia State District 41.
You might also say Jackson is something of a modern-day Pauli Murray. Pauli was truly one of a kind, but there are definitely people who are standing tall on Pauli's shoulders. Reverend Kim Jackson is one of them.
So, you know, there were a couple of things that I knew really clearly about myself as a young adult. One, I was called to ministry. Two, I was called to do the kind of ministry that brings about public change, that changes the world. So meeting Pauli Murray in paper, right, in books, she's my girl, right? Like, she did exactly what I feel very much called to do in my own life.
And just like Pauli, Reverend Jackson isn't only using the pulpit to push for change. She's also using the political stage as a state senator in Georgia. Pauli herself never held political office, but the two women are kindred spirits, protesting inequality and poking holes in patriarchal institutions. I spoke with Reverend Jackson just days before she was about to be sworn into office.
I am this African-American woman who was raised in the South in a Baptist tradition. And as a young adult, I came out as a lesbian. I also came out as saying I am a woman who feels called to ministry. in a church tradition that did not ordain women. And so I went searching for people who looked like me, for women who were Black, who were also serving or who had served historically as pastors and as priests in the church. And so, of course, Polly Murray was one of the first ones that came across my radar. I also joined the Episcopal Church and so was particularly inspired to find, you know, that Polly Murray was the first African-American woman Episcopal priest who also had this real passion for issues of social justice.
You had a mentor, though, and didn't even know it. You know, that's because she did the impossible when she decided to be a priest. You know, there were no other Black female priests, definitely not in the Episcopal Church.
That's right. You know, I have spent a lot of time talking about what it means to be the first. I am the first LGBTQ person who will be sworn in the state Senate here in Georgia. And so I've spent a lot of time talking about first. And I've also found a lot of inspiration and comfort in knowing that Polly Murray was a first in many things. She set the path for me and continues to inspire me even from the grave. I'll just say on Monday when I'm sworn in, I will be wearing a Polly Murray stole, a stole that she has passed down to other female Black priests in the church. I will wear one of those in honor of her.
Well, I hope you have a professional photographer somewhere nearby, not like a grandmama, mama, cousin with their phone shaking. No, we need a good picture, Rev. Jackson. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Please. So when you think of Polly Murray, what are some of her other actions do you think that you've adopted? You know, it's not just about theology, but actual, you know, the behaviors and practices too. So how do you see yourself living into Polly's legacy with your actions as a reverend and I think as a policymaker?
So one of the things that Polly Murray was very clear about was that women had a role in the society that was significantly greater than the role that she was born into, right? And I think coming from the rural South as I did, I grew up and was told that there are certain things that girls do and certain things that girls don't do. And, you know, one of those very specifically was being a pastor. Girls don't become preachers. That was very clearly expressed to me. And so, you know, defying that, and that's what Polly Murray did. I think over and over again, Polly Murray defied the norms, defied these really absolutely patriarchal rules. And I've tried to live into that as well. And every time I've kind of hit a barrier that said, you know, because you're a woman or because you're queer, you can't do these things. I've said, yes, yes, I can. I feel clear that perhaps it's as a part of my faith. I think some of it is just the sense of resistance that was birthed in me that has been passed down from our ancestors who resisted in all these different ways. I've said, yes, those barriers are not real. We can overcome those to really flourish and thrive in the society.
So have you found yourself out marching a lot lately? Have you gone, taken your actions to the streets as sort of this social change agent?
Absolutely. I've spent a lot of time marching in the streets. And in fact, I like to tell the story. I've spent more time on the steps of the Georgia Capitol leading rallies and protest than I have actually inside of the Capitol.
I hope that I will continue to do what I have tried to do most of my life. And that is, when there was a principle I felt that I ought to act on, I did not stand in fear of consequences.
Polly Murray continues to be hailed and celebrated by theologians and everyday people. In Chapel Hill, there's a current campaign to rename a street in Polly's name. This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Coldell Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. For co-host Jeff DeBerry, I'm Leonita Inge. For more Due South, go to DueSouthRadio.org. Download and subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen.